Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. So I thought we'd start the year as we mean to go on with better sex, better health, and a better you. And I have the perfect guest to discuss this with us, Dr. Nita Landry, OBGYN. Her inspiring new book, Dr. Nita's Crash Course for Women, answers many questions we didn't know we should ask about female sexuality, about orgasms, and what we need to know about the current state of STDs, which, by the way, is quite alarming, as well as updates on proactive health screenings for cancer of the breast and cervix, and how to find a doctor that you actually like. And I think that's super important because we've all been there. If you don't connect with your doctor, you don't trust your doctor, and it's a kind of no-win situation. Dr. Nita definitely has some solutions for us on many levels. She is an MD OBGYN, and in addition to co-hosting The Doctors, Dr. Nita Landry served as medical expert on other TV programs, including Good Morning America, The Today Show, Dr. Phil, CBS National News, and Black Entertainment Television. She served as an ambassador for National Women's Health Week from 2008 through 2021, and her new book is Dr. Nita's Crash Course for Women, Better Sex, Better Health, Better You. And here's my guest, Dr. Nita Landry. Dr. Nita Landry, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for chatting with me today.
Very pleased to have you here because so much has changed in the world of women's health over the last couple of years, and you've got the latest and greatest information here. But before we dive into the book, Crash Course for Women, just want to share a little bit about you and your background with our listeners, because that is interesting in and of itself. I saw on your Twitter handle, you put uplifting and inspiring teens and women through community service. And much of that you do through your skills as a media expert on shows like The Doctors and Dr. Phil and others. So first of all, I have to say congratulations to you, Dr. Nita, because as a little girl, you always wanted to be a doctor and a TV interviewer person, as you called it. So you're truly living your dream. So congratulations on that. And just share a little bit about how that went for you.
Well, as you mentioned, I always wanted to combine both of those worlds. And when I was younger, I did kind of get some chuckles and side eyes when I told people I wanted to work in the entertainment industry. So I learned about how people's opinions can really have a negative impact on your career trajectory if you let it. So I stopped telling people about that component of my career dreams. But I ended up going to medical school, as I always wanted to do, and I was traveling across the country practicing medicine because after residency, I decided to take a non-traditional path, and instead of just going to one clinic, I decided to go to a bunch of different clinics that needed help across the country, and I also worked on labor and delivery units, delivering babies, and like doing all the things that OBGYNs would do. And then I was in the Midwest one winter. And let me tell you, I'm from Louisiana, Vicki. So in Louisiana, we are not accustomed to that type of cold. And I was, it's a different kind of cold. And I was listening to the weather person on the news, and they were saying, it's colder here than it is in the North Pole, and like all of these other weather facts that didn't really impress me. At that point, I decided that maybe the Midwest in the winter wasn't the place for me, so I decided to put in my 30-day notice, and I ended up moving to California, where I started taking some entertainment classes, and I was able to be a guest expert on The Doctors, and it went well, and they asked me if I would be willing to be a guest co-host. And that went well. and one thing led to another, and I became one of the co-hosts in addition to practicing medicine. So that's kind of the blurb as right. far as how things unfolded, and here we are.
Well, it's an awesome story, and I wanted to share it with our listeners because so many people are sniggered at. I certainly remember being sniggered at one point, but, you know, you do have to kind of just ignore it and follow your dream, and here you are now. And the interesting thing, when you became a traveling doctor, I'm guessing that provided some great material for your book because you learned a lot about women as you were traveling around the country as a doctor. And the questions that they were asking and not asking, and here you are now with your first book.
Yes, you are absolutely correct. And I intentionally picked assignments that were very different. For example, 1 month I might be working on a Native American reservation. Now fast forward 4 or 5 months later, I may take an assignment in a busy inner city. Or in some cases, I was in very, very small towns. Like, for example, during one of my orientations, the person told me, you know, if you need any blood, we have 2 units of blood here. But if you need more, just let us know. We'll call the sheriff, and he'll drive over to the next town with his lights on, and he'll bring us some back. Now, luckily, we didn't need any blood. We didn't need to call the sheriff, but just to give you an idea of, like, how small some of these places were. And as I went from these busy places, these busy facilities, delivering, like, tons of babies when I was on a shift to these really small places where labor and delivery may have been closed while they were waiting for me to get there, I had an opportunity to meet so many amazing, amazing patients. And I took the time to really pay attention to what patients were asking, although they were coming from very different walks of life. And I also paid attention to what types of information would make light bulbs go off in these women's heads or would make their eyes sparkle when I started to answer questions that they didn't necessarily ask themselves, but questions that I thought would be useful. And when I was writing the book, I was very intentional about combining the questions that kept coming up over and over and over. I call them repeat offenders, these repeat offenders that have been impacting female health. And I also included those questions and answers that people don't necessarily ask, but I know it could be very beneficial when they're trying to figure out what's going on with their health, when they're trying to determine the best next step.
Yeah. And it is really packed full of information. I pulled out some questions from the book here that I'd like to address on the show. It's called Crash Course for Women, Better Sex, Better Health, Better You. And who doesn't want that?
Right.
So I would like to begin with breast cancer. According to the American Society of Cancer, breast cancer accounts for 30% of all new female cancers each year. They estimate that in 2022, almost 300,000 new cases of invasive breast cancer will be diagnosed in women, and that around 43,000 will actually die from breast cancer. So it's an important topic. And I know from a recent mammogram myself that the guidelines around self-checking and mammograms have changed. Would you share what's happened with that and what we need to know?
Yes. When it comes to breast cancer screening, one of the reasons that the screening guidelines can be a bit confusing is because they are not consistent from organization to organization. Basically, we have very reputable organizations that have taken the information and they've basically gone through it on their own, and they say, this is what we recommend based on the research. And what happens is not everybody recommends screening at the same time as far as age, and not everybody recommends the same screening intervals. What I would say is reputable organizations, say at 40, are some reputable organizations, such as the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, they say at 40 years of age, patients should have a conversation with their healthcare clinician and based on, you know, their family history, their personal history, and their personal beliefs, then they can determine if they want to start mammogram screenings at 40. Some organizations say start screening at 45. Everybody will say start screening by age 50. And then once you start screening, some organizations say screen annually, some say screen every 2 years. So when you think about it, you have to say, okay, well, what are the benefits of screening earlier and screening more frequently? Well, the benefit is going to be you would catch early stage breast cancer more frequently, which is ideal. Now, what would be the downside? Well, if you screen more frequently, then you have a higher chance of having a false positive, which means that you say there's an abnormality when there really isn't an abnormality there. And because of a false positive, you may need additional imaging or even biopsies, and it can cause depression and or anxiety that may kind of linger even if the follow-up testing is normal. And then, you know, they're uncomfortable as well. Although I would say it's worth the squeeze. the health benefits, they're worth the squeeze. But, yeah, you think about things like that. But to sum things up, I would say if you are a person with an average risk of breast cancer, meaning you don't have a strong family history, you don't have personal things going on with your health that put you at an increased risk, at 40, have a conversation with your doctor, truly understand the risks and the potential benefits, and then make the best decision for yourself.
Right. And I want to ask you about calcification, because I have three friends who all went to for mammograms and came back and had to go back and have diagnostics because there was calcification in the breast. What is happening there? What causes it?
Well, those are going to be calcium deposits that happen on the mammogram. And when we look at the mammogram, they're going to show up as kind of like bright white specks on the mammogram. And so they aren't connected to your diet. That's one thing that I want people to know, because a lot of times people will think that it's diet related, but they're not connected to calcium in your diet. And those calcifications themselves, they don't develop into breast cancer, but they are a marker for some type of underlying process that's occurring in the breast tissue. And in most cases, it's going to be something benign, meaning it's something that's not associated with cancer. But anytime you see any types of calcifications, you do want to be mindful. And sometimes that they can signify that there's something else going on, meaning something cancerous, but that's not always the case. So you really have to take that on a case-by-case basis.
Okay, good to know. And what about gynecological exams? Have the guidelines changed around that? It's no wonder it's so confusing if organizations are putting out their own guidelines. I mean, we really do have to have this conversation with our doctors, don't we?
Yes. It's the same thing. When we look at pap smears, the guidelines change from time to time. And it's the same thing with the mammograms. I told you where organizations are now. Now, fast forward 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, we may be having a totally different conversation. And that's why I always tell people, you keep coming and we'll keep reading and we'll do what the most up-to-date guidelines state that we should be doing. But regarding your question, when it comes to the pap smears, it's going to be the same thing. In the past, it was like, oh, you should have a pap smear every year. But then they took a step back and they started looking at all of these things. And now they say if someone is less than 30 and they have normal pap smears and they're not having any specific symptoms, then they should just have a pap smear every 3 years. If someone is 30 years of age or older, and we usually stop paps at 65 unless, you know, the patient wants additional paps, or unless they've had abnormal paps in the past that have required some type of excision procedure or ablation procedure because of those abnormalities. But from 30 to 65, we typically do pap smears every 5 years along with high-risk HPV screening.
Okay, good. And so let's talk about sex. A lot of the book you cover issues around sex, and you're very open about this and quite funny and made me laugh out loud a couple of times because goodness knows we need to laugh these days. But you want people to, you want women especially to enjoy and have sexual pleasure versus focusing on that orgasm. So according to the stats, there's an orgasm gap. It's at something like 95% for heterosexual men versus only 65% for heterosexual women. So let's unpack that a little and what's going on with that big gap there.
Well, I think there are a lot of contributing factors. And one of them is going to be the fact that for a long time, women have been encouraged to downplay their sexuality and not really be vocal or embrace the things that truly bring them pleasure when they are having these sexual experiences. And so I think that's going to be a major factor. But something else I want to point out is in the book, we talk about how leading sex experts will encourage people to focus on pleasure more so than orgasms overall, just because one of the best analogies I've heard is a sex therapist who said they think of a sexual experience as a dining experience. You know, when you walk in, you have bread, you have this great meal, you have dessert, you have maybe some coffee or something after, you grab a mint on the way out, like it's the whole experience. And they equated to the dessert to orgasms, and they were basically saying that it's a nice part of the meal, but they want you to focus on everything. So they really want you to focus on pleasure. But overall, when it comes to the orgasm gap, I think it has to do with just our mentality around sex as women, and kind of what we've been taught, the lies that we've been fed, mm-hmm. like good little girls don't do this, respectable women don't do this, or respectable women don't do that. And then just kind of embracing our anatomy. Like a lot of times people will say, you know, I can have an orgasm if my clitoris is stimulated, but I don't have an orgasm just during penetration in a heterosexual encounter, and they'll be disappointed. Well, the clitoris is basically like the female equivalent of the penis. So from just a realistic standpoint, we wouldn't tell guys, oh, let's just ignore your penis and focus on something else, and if you can't have an orgasm, then that means that, you know, something is wrong. We would say, oh, the penis is a very logical body part to focus on when we're talking about male pleasure. Well, it's the same thing with females. And in a lot of positions, the clitoris isn't being adequately stimulated from just penetration. So I think we have to take a lot of different things into consideration, but we definitely do talk about a lot of that in the book.
Yes, you do. I loved when you said, I mean, I laughed out loud, actually, when I read this in your book. You write, and I'm paraphrasing, it's almost like the female orgasm, whether it's fake or real, is the standing ovation for man's performance.
Yes!
You know, because men have misconceptions around orgasm, too, so we need to educate them, too.
We do, and one more thing I want to point out is that for a lot of women, you know, I'm not saying run away from the orgasm if it's coming your way, like embrace
it. Well, no, take it.
yeah, go ahead and accept that. But a lot of women also really, really value the emotional connection that comes along with sex. And in some cases, in many cases, women value that emotional connection as much, if not more, than the orgasm itself. So we have to have this conversation about why is it that we say that you have to have an orgasm to have quote-unquote successful sex. Well, if that's what one person wants, then that's fine. But if you have one or 50% of, you know, the relationship wanting that emotional connection, we we can't downplay the importance of that. So focusing on what really makes sex pleasurable for you is going to be very important. And if your partner is thinking that it's only about the orgasm, when for you, a big part of it is also the emotional connection, then that's a conversation you need to have.
Yes, yes. So let's look at the flip side of the pleasure. And one of the not so great things about having sex is that you may pick up an STD. And from all the stats I've seen, it's on the rise. And you certainly talk about this in the book. So what do we need to know? Because as I understand it from your work, there are STDs out there with basically no symptoms, and yet they're doing us some harm. So what do we need to know at a high level?
At a very high level, you need to know what you just stated, that there are many STDs that don't have any symptoms. For instance, people with gonorrhea or chlamydia may not have any symptoms. But even if you don't have symptoms, they can still cause long-term complications, for example, infertility in women. So the only way to know for sure if you have a sexually transmitted infection is to be tested. And then it's also important to know what symptoms might pop up if you do develop symptoms, how long it'll take those symptoms to pop up, and it's important to know how long it will take tests to turn positive if you do become infected. For example, if you get chlamydia on a Monday, then your test won't be positive on a Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. Right. And age has not a lot to do with it. I think it was about 50% of people who have an STD were between the age of 15 to 24. But the other 50% are between 25 and however old you are when you stop having sex. I mean, there's a lot of cases out there. So older people, I think, tend to think this doesn't apply to them, but it certainly does.
It does. And a couple of things you said there. First of all, you said however old you are when you stop having sex. And I like that you said that, because some people are like, oh, well, you know, I'm 60 now, so yeah, I'm just done. Like, no, I met 60-something, 70-something year olds who said they are having the best sex of their life. So don't put an age limit on your sex life if that's what you want to do. But yeah, there are millions and millions of sexually transmitted infections diagnosed each year, and everybody who is sexually active needs to be knowledgeable about sexually transmitted infections, because they don't discriminate. And they are also on the rise in the senior citizen population. And a lot of senior citizens, because they, you know, women won't get pregnant, they don't worry about using condoms. But condom use is very important. And people should also remember that you can get and or give a sexually transmitted infection from getting or receiving oral sex. So in addition to condoms, you know, you want to be mindful and use dental dams or another protective barrier when getting or receiving oral sex.
Right, right. And in your book, you say, talking about HPV, and I forget the full name of it, but you obviously will remember that. But you say that by the age of 50, 4 out of 5 women will have been infected at some point in their life with that?
Yes. Human papillomavirus, also known as HPV, is very, very common. And luckily, many people with, or most people with the human papillomavirus, also known as HPV, will go on to suppress the virus so that they don't go on to have long-term complications such as cervical cancers or precancers or genital warts. But it is very, very common. And when I talk about cancers versus warts, one high-level thing to remember is that when you think about HPV, there are high-risk HPVs and low-risk HPVs. High-risk HPVs are associated with genital cancers and precancers, whereas low-risk HPVs are associated with genital warts. So when we talk about pap smears, we are doing a pap smear along with high-risk HPV screening. So if you have one of those tests, and if you have high-risk HPV, that's different from the type of HPV that can lead to genital warts.
Okay. Hormones is a big issue that I've heard many people talk about, and it can again be quite controversial. Some folks swear by hormone treatments, others advise against them. I know my own sister had hormone treatments and had to stop because they made her feel rageful. She just said she would have these rages that came on. So they obviously didn't suit her. But a lot of people think compound medicines are better for us than pharmaceuticals, if you will. You say compound hormones, where the product is custom made for the patient and they claim to be safer, you say that's incorrect. Just share a little on that, if you would.
Right. And people do assume that compounded hormones are safer. And when I say compounded hormones, you know, we're talking about custom made products. And these products have been tailored to a specific patient's need based on the physician's prescription. But compounded hormones have not been proven to be safer. When you look at compounding pharmacies, they don't have as much oversight in a lot of cases as your traditional pharmacies. So, and they don't always, and so because they don't have as much oversight, you may not be getting a consistent level of ingredients in whatever product they're giving you. So my advice is to use FDA-approved products when you're talking about hormones, just because, you know, they are so important, and they can help a lot of people for sure. So I'm definitely not anti-hormones, but I just want to make sure that individuals are doing it in a safe way.
Yes. And as far as vitamins and nutritional supplements, you give a list in the book of your sure give it a try list, it might work, and a pass list. So again, that's some trial and error kind of thing for people.
Correct. And my whole thing with supplements is, first of all, I want to make sure that we have enough evidence to say that they are safe and are effective. So that's going to be the main thing. But ultimately, I'm a big believer in individuals just getting all of the information from a reliable source, a source that they trust. And once they have that information, then they can make the best decision for themselves.
Mm. It all boils down to having a good relationship with your doctor and having these conversations. And a lot of people find it difficult to find a doctor that they connect with or that they feel gives them the time that they need. I'm really lucky. I have a nurse practitioner now, and she's wonderful. But I wonder if you'd share what kind of questions that we should be asking when we're looking for a new doctor.
When you are looking for a new doctor, my first big piece of advice would be to talk to someone who has kind of a similar health style as you, meaning, you know, some people are really into the holistic approach, whereas some people just, they're looking for a pill. So getting just recommendations from friends, family members, coworkers who live a similar lifestyle to you are, who have a similar health perspective, can be very beneficial. But when you are looking for a doctor, I think it's also important to ask your friends and family members why they like their doctor. Like, does their doctor take the time to listen to their questions? Does their doctor really take the time to explain things clearly? And once again, circling back to the treatment options, when they present an issue, how does the doctor approach that issue? Are they really thinking about it in a holistic manner, or are they just going to say, hey, take this particular pill? And making sure that whatever your friend or family member is telling you is really resonating with you. Because if you don't vibe with your doctor for whatever reason, then you're going to be less likely to implement their advice.
Yeah.
And in the long term, that can really have a negative impact on your health.
Yes. And you're highly specialized. You're an OBGYN. I just mentioned I'm seeing a nurse practitioner. What should people who see nurse practitioners versus doctors, medical doctors, consider? What should they be aware of?
I think you ask the same questions, and I know a lot of wonderful nurse practitioners. They do a great job taking care of patients, and as a physician, I've personally seen nurse practitioners. But I think overall, whether you're talking to a doctor or a nurse practitioner, you should just make sure that they are qualified to handle the issue that you have. And in some cases, physicians may have training that a nurse practitioner may not have, like if you need a surgery or something like that. But overall, I would say ask the same questions when you're looking around. But in some cases, the nurse practitioner may say, hey, this goes beyond the scope of what you do as nurse practitioners. And in this particular situation, I do think you need to see a physician.
Okay. Okay, good to know. Well, the book is packed full of really great information. We've barely touched, we've barely scratched half of the subjects in there. And some great illustration in there, which I was quite fascinated with because, we'll let listeners figure that out when they get the book. But it explains stuff that doesn't normally get explained. At the end of Crash Course for Women, you mentioned Stephen Pressfield's book, which is one of my it's on my bookshelf too, The War of Art. He shares how most of us live two lives, the one we live and the life we're capable of. What do you want listeners to know about living our best life when it comes to physical and sexual health? What do you want them to take away from this conversation?
I want listeners to, just from a sexual standpoint, be true to who you are and be true to what you want, and be willing to vocalize that. I think as women, a lot of times when it comes to sexual experiences, we will focus on our partner's pleasure more so than our own. And that's not fair, and I'm not okay with that. And I feel as though if you're in a healthy relationship, then your partner should be as willing to please you as you are wanting to please them. So that's very important. And then when it comes to our health, I would say I want women to remember to not take their health for granted. A lot of times we prioritize everything above exercising, or, you know, we don't have time to do, you know, to cook, so we just grab fast food and things like that. But if someone were to say, would you be willing to, or if someone were to say, okay, you are prioritizing your job, for example, over your health, well, would you rather be sick, or would you rather not get this promotion or something like that?
Right.
Then I think people would choose their health. So just be mindful of that and prioritize your health. And also develop an all or some mentality. Sometimes we say, oh, I don't have an hour to go to the gym or something. Well, what can you do? When you're walking, can you take the stairs instead of taking the elevator up a couple of flights? Can you just exercise for 15 minutes or take a walk after eating for 15 minutes as opposed to going to the gym for an hour or an hour and a half? So just, you know, prioritize your health and be true to who you are and know that you deserve to be the healthiest, happiest version of yourself.
I love it. And talking of being true to yourselves, we've been using the pronouns he, she, but you devote a chapter to transgender health and becoming a respectful ally, which is the first time I've seen that in a book. So kudos on that. I think it's important. And I have one final question for you, and it's totally off the beaten track here, but I saw that when I was putting my notes together that you had been on TV with a fear of dogs, and I'm wondering if you overcame that fear now.
We're still working on that.
I ask as a dog lover. I it hurts when I see people who are afraid of dogs, but it's a very real fear for many, I know.
It is, but you know, we are a work in progress.
Well, that's all we can ask for, right? We're all works in progress. Dr. Nita Landry, what a pleasure talking with you. The book is Crash Course for Women, Better Sex, Better Health, Better You. And I know listeners can find out much more about you and your work at drnitalandry.com. So thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate you taking the time to chat.
My pleasure. If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, I'm Carson Kressley. Of all the resources in the world, kindness is the most precious. For more than 140 years, American Humane has been working to protect animals in disasters, on farms, on the silver screen, and in zoos and aquariums, caring for the world's vanishing creatures. You can help too by making humane choices every day. Visit AmericanHumane.org for simple ways to build a more caring and compassionate world for all of us.